This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Good Things, the show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Darshan Johan. Transformative Justice Collective is a collective founded on the principles of transformative justice and committed to seeking the reform of Singapore's criminal punishment system, starting with the abolition of the death penalty. They've been important figures in pushing the Singapore government to grant clemency for Nagendran Dharmalingam, who was unfortunately executed on the 27th. Joining me on the show today is Kokila Annamalai. She's an organizer at the Transformative Justice Collective. Welcome to the show, Kokila.
Hi, Darshan. It's been an emotional roller coaster today, but I am taking a moment to soak in the temporary victory that we've had today with Dakshinamurthy Kattaiah's case.
You guys have been playing an integral role in trying to help the family, whether it's Dakshina, whether it's Nagendran. Tell me, what exactly is Transformative Justice Collective all about?
So Transformative Justice Collective is a grassroots organization that is abolitionist in spirit. So it seeks the abolition of the death penalty, but also the abolition of all cruel and inhumane practices under the legal system that are justified by a legal system, and that actually includes the abolition of the prison system, the police, and all oppression and oppressive systems, right? So that's the principles on which TJC is founded. So we do work on issues such as prison conditions, drug policy, the death penalty, judicial caning that is still, you know, present in Singapore, in the judicial system. And we also parallelly work on building up public resources, capacities, and community-based capacities for restorative and transformative justice approaches. So alternatives to prisons and policing is what we are committed to, so that when there is harm or there is conflict and harm in our communities and societies, we don't turn to the police and prison system, but instead have our own resources and capacities to respond to harm and transforming the ways we think about justice and what it looks like to put things right, what it looks like to heal and to build safety in our communities, what it looks like to get justice for people who have experienced harm and in a way that turns away from violent systems like police and prisons.
Why, Kokila, did you decide, or you and your team decide to start this initiative? I'm wondering if, you know, there was this light bulb moment, so to speak, where something in particular happened that y'all came together and said, you know, enough is enough, we need to start this. Or was it just, did it just happen organically? Share the backstory of the founding of this collective.
So there were actually, I would say, a few factors. We founded maybe about 1.5 years ago now. So we're still quite a young collective. But many of us who started it were independent activists working on issues around the criminal punishment system in our own ways. So, you know, some of us had done work around the Internal Security Act and detentions without trial. Some of us were anti-death penalty activists. Some of us had done work around access to justice issues and due process issues.
What were you working on specifically prior to this?
So I had, I would say it's been a bit of everything here and there. So I was involved in a protest against the ISA a few years ago, and also organized campaigns around access to justice and intimidation of activists and dissenters, you know, and journalists, and so people who are speaking up on issues. They're the ways that the legal system has been used to intimidate them are some of the issues. So like civil political rights issues connected to how police and prisons are used, right? And how the law is used to suppress our political and civil rights are some of the issues that I was working on in relation to what TJC is doing now, right? So I've also been working on migrant workers' rights and poverty and, you know, different sorts of human rights issues, LGBT rights and things like that over the years.
Right.
But TJC specifically came about when, and I would say there were a few factors. One was Parthi Liani's case. There was a case where this migrant worker, migrant domestic worker Parthi Liani from Indonesia went up against her previous employer, who basically accused her of theft.
Right.
And they're very, very, very wealthy family, one of the wealthiest families in Singapore, very prominent family, accused her of theft. And it was a 4-year court case where she denied all the charges. And eventually, after 4 years of struggle, she was acquitted. But this case became a landmark case in Singapore, embedding itself in the public consciousness because of its David and Goliath kind of nature, right? Because here is a domestic worker, you know, I'm a migrant domestic worker at that, who's one of the most disenfranchised groups in Singapore,
right,
who decided to fight her case against this very powerful family. I mean, when I say fight against them, it's not like it's a civil case, it's a criminal case for theft. But yet, you know, that she dared to challenge this. When many, many migrant workers just end up going to prison because they can't afford to stay in Singapore and fight this case. And they, you know, they don't have anything on the side, right? There is no, they don't have the money to hire a good lawyer. They don't have the right to work here while they are, you know, involved in a case. So in Bharati's case, she stayed at a shelter and she was unable to work for all of those 4 years. So it's a very long struggle. And often they are advised to just accept the charges, serve their time and then go home, right? And their work permits are then canceled. They're never allowed to work in Singapore again. So even if there are false charges brought, completely scurrilous charges brought, they're often in a very precarious situation. And I think there were a lot of issues in the case, from starting with how the police conducted themselves, how she was treated while in remand, the way she was interrogated for hours on end through the night, you know, like late into the night, and wasn't provided proper translation support, and so many access to justice issues in that case. And the fact that she won, it left a deep impression on people. And we could see that the tides were turning in terms of people's willingness, the public's willingness to be critical of Singapore's legal system. Before that, I think there was this very strong sense that everything is fair. In Singapore, things are all above board. Everything's done very clean. Everything's, you know, there's a lot of due process. Like people, there was a lot of credulity in the system. And activists had a very hard time pointing out the many systemic issues in access to justice here, right? The fact that marginalized people are often face a tremendous battle, whichever side they're on, whether you are the one who's a victim or you are an accused person. When you are a marginalized person, the system does not serve you in many ways, whether it is police procedures, whether it is the court system, you know, that these are really difficult to navigate as somebody, not a position of power, right? So we had very difficult time convincing people on these issues because it was still very abstract. But Parthi Liani's case provided a story, and that always is what I think reaches people, right? So then we could discuss all these structural, systemic issues, but we had a story as an inroad, and it is because of her courage. So you see, so that was one entry point. And then there was Saeed Suhail, who was a death row prisoner who was up for execution, and he decided to challenge it, right? So, and his lawyer, M. Ravi, he brought a case on the discriminatory nature of his execution, right? Because he wanted to bring a case saying that, you know, he was up for execution because of the COVID pandemic and the fact that the borders were closed and family members of Malaysian death row prisoners would not be able to come and visit them. And as a result of that, he felt that they had skipped over some of the Malaysian death row prisoners and scheduled him for execution. But that was one issue. And he also had a few other cases that he was trying to bring before the court. And at the time, he wrote a letter to lawyer M. Ravi that Ravi published online. And that letter was very moving, in which he talked about this rush to execute during a pandemic when there is a lockdown and so many people are suffering. Why this bloodthirstiness of the state? And that letter also had a huge reach. And so I think people were starting to have more sympathy feel more connected to these stories of people behind bars and people who are coming up against the justice system. And there were also a few cases of sexual harassment and sexual assault at the time where the accused persons involved were people from more, you know, sort of middle class, upper middle class backgrounds, right? So NUS students there were cases against them of sexual harassment, in which case the judges made some pronouncements in court about them having bright futures and therefore giving them sort of like more lenient sentences, which we are not against in principle. Right. I want to say that up front, because a lot of people push for equality on the basis of, you know, it becomes a race to the bottom, treat everybody as you know, harshly as possible. Where else, mm-hmm. what I think, if anything, we were to say on that would be, why don't people from more marginalized backgrounds get that same sort of, you know, benefit of doubt, where their lives, their futures are also considered, right? So, but the fact that the law is so harsh against so many people, so many ordinary people, but when it was, you know, NUS students, like National University of Singapore students who were Chinese, you know, from like more privileged backgrounds, and not saying that the judges ruled on those basis, you know, that's not the assertion I'm making at all, that was a factor, but it again left an imprint on the public consciousness that their futures as university students was taken into consideration to give them a lenient sort of sentence, but that, you know, the futures of other students or other young people who might not have the same privileges, you know, or who are not university students, may not have been considered, right? So these things, we were seeing the groundswell of people finally becoming more open to being critical of the criminal punishment system and of the judicial system as a whole. And we thought, okay, we need to take, you know, we need to wield this opportunity and organize around it, because, you know, these things happen and then things die off, right?
Right.
Something else happens, it dies off. Something else happens, things die down. So we said, no, we need to seize the opportunity to organize around this. And that's why the Transformative Justice Collective was formed, to have more sustained engagement and build momentum around these flashpoints that had happened rather than letting them die down. And also at that time, anti-death penalty activism in Singapore had sort of quieted. The one or two small groups that existed before had sort of disbanded. And so it was just independent activists doing things. And we said, no, we need to come together, support each other, and bring more people into this work. And for that, we need an organization. So that's why TGC was set up.
Kokila, why is the Singapore government seemingly proud of the death penalty? And that's what prominent human rights lawyer Latifa Koya used to describe the Singapore government when I interviewed her as well, because many countries in this region still have the death penalty, even Malaysia, and that's highly unfortunate. But I think maybe we are in a stage right now where governments that come and go aren't necessarily proud of it. There's been a moratorium on all executions since 2018, but Singapore has been on a execution spree. And it's always just, you know, PAP's way or the highway. What do you think?
Yeah, I think what you say is so true, that even other countries and jurisdictions that retain the death penalty, they're not as proud of it, right? But with Singapore, it's such a big part of the PAP's identity, right? Of ruling with an iron fist, of being uncompromising. And it's very tied to their narrative, the state narrative of how precarious Singapore is, that we're all always on the verge of rioting with each other, or of Malaysia and Indonesia or other neighboring countries being a threat to us, and that the PAP is needed to keep us safe from all the threats. You know, it's the nanny state rhetoric, right? And so, you know, there are all these, like, they make bogeymen out of these drug traffickers, or, you know, just poor boys who are just transporting a package for a bit of cash. That's who is on death row here, let's be clear, right? They're not people who are scheming, manipulating to, like, bring a drug scourge to Singapore. They're just pawns in this capitalist game of the drug trade, right? And but the narrative, they want to create the narratives of them as these dangerous criminals, because then it reinforces and lends power to their role as gatekeepers, as people who are needed for our protection as citizens of Singapore, right? So not just the death penalty. On so many issues, the state's narrative is consistent in that you are at risk, you are all at, you know, under threat constantly, we're under siege from all these different things, terrorism, drugs, all of this. And we and our iron-fisted rule is what keeps you safe, is what keeps Singapore together. You know, we're all, our well-being and safety is hanging by this thread. And it's Singapore that needs, it's Singapore government, and the PAP, that is needed to fortify, you know, our safety. So I think there is a lot of political investment for the PAP in maintaining the death penalty, because it is so tied to their overall narrative of why they are necessary, and only them, right, as a party, are capable of protecting the people of Singapore.
Right. Do the Singapore masses agree with you with a lot of what you're saying right now, or do they think you're absolutely crazy? And I ask this because, you know, earlier in the show you brought up things like, you know, in the long term, you know, what TJC is about is, you know, you'll start with the death penalty, but ultimately it's about defunding the police, it's about abolishing all these systems of oppression. Does the Singapore masses agree with you? Where does the Singapore masses stand, and what do they do? How do they respond when you say these things?
No, of course the Singapore masses don't want to abolish the police and the prisons, right?
Right.
I mean, I think that's true for the masses anywhere,
absolutely.
So there's always vitriol, for sure. But there has been a very moving, unprecedented groundswell of support for abolition of the death penalty at the very least. And I think Nagin's case was very important. As a rallying force for many people. But I think a lot of people who started out saying, why are we executing a man with an intellectual disability, have now moved on to considering many of the other factors involved in why the death penalty is so deeply problematic, right? So I think that's been a very important victory for us. Like for a lot of people, it was okay, Nagin is an exception. We shouldn't execute somebody like Nagin. But the conversation has definitely shifted from that. I mean, it has been very encouraging to see the level of nuance, the level of passion in the discourse here from younger people, as well as older people. You know, like the number of mothers who showed up to the vigil we had last week for Nagin and Dachna, the number of Indian, you know, Tamil women and mothers who came and embraced Dachna's mother. And these are not women who would come to Hong Lim Park for a protest, okay?
Right.
Be clear on that. There were so many people there who would, like my mother was there and she read the Shiva Puranam, right? And that would, like, who would think you would hear the Shiva Puranam being read at a Hong Lim Park vigil?
Right. As a protest, I watched the video and it was shocking in the most powerful manner possible. Like I, as a Malaysian, like watching this happening in Singapore, it was mind-blowing, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, and there were Buddhist prayers, there were Catholic prayers. You know, I think it's tremendous. The support for abolition is definitely growing. That is why the state feels threatened and they're pushing back harder. They're making it more hostile for lawyers to act. They're trying to make it much more difficult to bring late stage applications. So that's when you know you're having an impact, right? Because when the pushback gets strong, of course they will try to intimidate. And a lot of people might think of that as a sign that we are failing, right? That things actually, in many ways, the environment is becoming more hostile, but it is only because they feel threatened because we are getting more powerful, right? And then I was also going to say the other thing that's been very encouraging is the amount of analysis that a lot of people are bringing to this, right? That people are, again, like I said, they've moved on from don't execute this one vulnerable person to, no, the death penalty itself is racist because so many people on death row are Malay and Tamil people in Singapore who are the minorities, right? And people have moved on to talking about how just the prison system as a whole disproportionately punishes people in circumstances of desperation, people who are poor, people who have no real opportunities to thrive in our society. how there are disproportionately people with disabilities, people who have had very difficult lives in so many ways, in prison as a whole, not just on death row. You know, people are much more critical of conditions on death row. Why are they kept in solitary cells for all of those years? You know, why don't they have contact visits? And it's made people recognize the cruelty of the prison system as a whole, and of the death penalty, of judicial caning, of all of these things have come into the conversation. So I think there's definitely much more support, even for some radical positions like prison abolition at this point. Yeah.
On the show with me today is Kokila Annamalai. She's an organizer at the Transformative Justice Collective in Singapore. After a break, I ask her if they're facing any pressure from the Singapore government for doing their activism. Keep it here on Good Things, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things with me, Dashran Johan. My guest on today's episode is Kokila Annamalai. She's one of the founding members and an organizer at the Transformative Justice Collective in Singapore. So, Kokila, do you guys face a lot of pressure from PAP, from the Singapore government? Because as far as I'm aware, ISA is still a thing in Singapore. We know that the democratic space in Singapore isn't that big. It is a country where the Prime Minister and his government rules with an iron fist. It's like we talked about just a few minutes ago. It's this my way or the highway sort of approach. We've heard about, you know, Singapore's history, similar to Malaysia's history, where at one point they would make people disappear, you know, for activism. Where is Singapore right now? And how do y'all combat these challenges?
So definitely the democratic space in Singapore has always been abysmal, and it's shrinking further. Right? I mean, when I say always, I say since the PAP came to power.
Right.
Yeah. But it's shrinking further with things like POFMA and FICA in recent years. I mean, you must have heard about the Foreign Interference Countermeasures Act.
Right.
It's a devastating act. It cripples activism, journalism, everything, even community spaces. You know, like
right.
Everything is suffocated by FICA. And there's been even more action of late against independent media, you know, like the Online Citizen's chief editor, Terry Tsu, has just been imprisoned. And TOC has been shut down. It was the only alternate media space that was truly independent for the longest time. Now it's gone. And, you know, so many of the human rights lawyers that used to be able to represent activists have lost their licenses or are being charged, are facing different kinds of intimidation, or have succumbed to such kinds of possible pressures and therefore stopped doing that kind of work. You know, so I would say the assets of civil society, what little we had, an independent media outlet, one that we
right.
had, or a few lawyers, there were already only two or three, like they're gone. Right? So we're losing the little assets that we've managed to build up with great difficulty and with you know, so much. It's very tragic. And I think we also need to take time to mourn the losses that we have, because it's, yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I find it very difficult to describe the extremely suffocating environment within which we try to do what we can. And I would say, you know, the kind of intimidations or pressures we face are not just in the form of actual overt actions taken against us legally.
Like what?
Or getting sued. Like people, increasingly activists have also, you know, faced, even this year we've had a few suits, like defamation suits and things like that against our friends. So those things aside, there are many other ways in which we face pressures, right? Like activists, people involved with TJC, many of them find it difficult to get jobs because, you know, those things are also blocked by in different ways, right? There's a lot of soft power at play too. And it shows up in the ways that we have to increasingly navigate a lot of legal threats and other kinds of threats when we decide how to run a particular campaign, right? It shows up in the fact that we can't find a space to have an event or to organize something. And it shows up in the fact that people will not give us any money,
right.
That we can't register ourselves as a society or as a you know, as an independent body, we can't raise funds. So then how do we grow our work if we don't have a physical, we don't have access to physical spaces to meet, we don't have access to money. So it, the pressures are not just in the form of legal threats, but in all of these other ways that serve as obstacles and very serious barriers to organizing and building power and being effective, right? Like in, if you see just across the border in Malaysia, there are entire NGOs devoted to abolition of the death penalty with paid staff.
Right. Absolutely.
And TGC is a group of volunteers, right? So, and trying to work on all these fronts simultaneously.
You know, yeah,
work, it's... Just, we have a prison conditions report coming out. We're trying to do restorative justice facilitation. We are trying to do work around drug policy, the death penalty, and as just a small group of volunteers. So that's what the effect of that undemocratic space is. And I think we need to recognize those kinds of deeper, far-reaching effects beyond, are you getting sued or are you, you know, having a charge filed against, a criminal case brought against you? Yeah.
So Kokila, how on earth did y'all manage to organize a protest where hundreds of people showed up, given everything that you just told me? How did that come about?
I think, again, it has been the power of stories. Yeah, so we... With Nagin's campaign, it's really been such an amazing story of his struggles on death row, but also of his family's perseverance, of his spirit of, you know, incredible hope and perseverance. It's just, yeah, I think it's telling those stories and telling the story of their struggles and suffering, but also of their humanity, right? And of their unrelenting fight to save his life. And I think similarly with Dachna, similarly with Saeed Suhail, when we ran a campaign for him last year, we did a letter writing campaign trying to encourage more people to write letters to Saeed when he was facing execution. And you know, the prison didn't let any of the letters reach him. And so it's, I think all of these things, like, have definitely had an impact. And I think also speaking to people, not just about, I think it is important to speak to people, not just about the oppressions we face, but about the power we have to challenge that, right? So with Nagin, we organized different communities to speak up for him as a collective. So, you know, we had a statement by healthcare workers, social service workers, social workers, community workers. We had a statement by artists, we had a statement by environmentalists in support of him. We had I think other groups of workers also, like I'm forgetting now. And then we had a statement by people with disabilities, you know, a statement, a collective action also by families, members of death row prisoners. So 232 family members of death row prisoners signed a letter to the president asking for clemency for Nagin. So in these ways, we were speaking to people about their power to act as a collective, right? So it's not just as individuals that we can oppose this, but to organize ourselves and to recognize that we have a voice as a collective. I think those things have had an effect in moving people. You know, so things like, you know, drug users and ex-users of drugs are a very stigmatized population here. And they're often only engaged with as either people who have done something illegal, you know, criminals, or as people who need treatment and need social services and welfare, but never as people who have a political voice. Right? So we organized a statement by them also against the execution of Nagin. So I think reminding people that you have a voice and that your voice matters has been a very important step in my view. And also, I think many, many people have been deeply touched and felt a personal connection to death row prisoners who have for a very long time in Singapore not had a voice, right? Because journalists are not allowed to just go in and meet them. Like I told you, it's like, even our letters are sent, so they're not allowed to reach them. They're not allowed to write to us. You know, there's so many barriers. They don't have a vote. They don't have so many basic civil and political rights, right? So in that sense, their voices have been utterly suppressed, and that's allowed the state to continue to have its narrative only heard in terms of who they are. So you only hear about who they are from CNB statements, the statement CNB releases about how these are criminals who could have destroyed these many families and these many lives, or the media narratives that are carried about, you know, drug users or people involved in the drug trade. That's the only narrative people have had, and the death penalty has been very abstract. But once they hear their voices and the voices of families, it's no longer abstract. Right? The contradictions fall apart. When you see that these are all vulnerable people, you cannot then hold that together with this dangerous person out to destroy society kind of narrative that's right. put out. And for the longest time, families have been very reluctant to speak out in Singapore. And here's where I think we have to give a lot of credit to the Malaysian families that have spoken up. In fact, it is Malaysian families that have moved the needle in Singapore, because the Malaysian families have been very brave in speaking up, because there is, I think we have to acknowledge that there is a stronger democratic spirit in Malaysia than in Singapore. People are more used to speaking up. There is more space, right? There is more democratic space. And so they have been more activist, the families. And so we've also tried to use that as examples to encourage local families of death row prisoners to speak up and have voice. And we've had one or two families be more vocal over the last few years. And I think we've also been trying to do a lot of work around addressing the stigma in speaking up. Because here, that's what has been very difficult for families, is that when they speak up, there is a lot of hate, a lot of vitriol, because the state narrative is so internalized by many people, right? So it's a very hostile environment for them to speak up to. So giving them support on that front, and then managing their exposure, their risks, but slowly, you know, expanding the space for them to speak up and controlling the narrative more. So we don't, for example, give, you know, like mainstream media journalists access to them to do interviews, because right. then they will publish it in ways that invites more hatred. So we just use our own platforms, right? We put up videos or stories, and we control the narrative a bit more that way. And then they're able to see supportive responses that encourages the next family member to speak up. So it's a lot of, you know, I think these kinds of slow steps have created and opened up the space a lot more.
Have you come across arguments, either in Singapore, or perhaps even more so from people from outside of Singapore, where when you say all of these things, right, whatever you're talking to me about right now, people say, dude, why la? You need activism in Singapore. You know, Singapore is so great. You know, I've heard this a lot. You know, Singapore is so great. You know, everybody is happy. There's salaries are great. What's up? Why y'all want to complain? Have you heard these sorts of arguments? And if you have, how do you usually respond to them?
I mean, I think, okay, so for one, I think that during the pandemic, you know, the lockdown and the migrant worker dormitories, that has definitely changed a lot of people's impression of Singapore, whether within Singapore or beyond, because that got a lot of international attention. And I think the horrifying conditions in which migrant workers are kept here, and the segregation, you know, the differentiated treatment of migrant workers and Singaporeans, which continues to this day, to our great dismay and horror. Even in the COVID protocols, right? Singaporeans can now go clubbing, but migrant workers still can't leave their dorms without an exit pass that is rationed. So it's. I think this has shattered some of this kind of romanticization and rose-tinted sort of a understanding of Singapore as a society. But in my conversations with people, I have not found it difficult to poke at this, you know, I think smoke screen
right.
of Singapore as this ideal place, because I think when you've had sort of intimate experiences of much of the injustices and marginalization that goes on here, and you're able to tell those stories or point to those realities, then I have found that generally people are able to recognize it. Whether or not they see it as bad enough is a different question. But I think it's like that story, you know, of Omelas, the people who walk away from Omelas. So it's a story of, I'm not saying it as poetically as the original writing is, but it's a story of how there is this like perfect, beautiful city that everyone is very happy in. And then the people find out that there is a child kept locked in a basement and tortured and that is the price to pay for this beautiful, happy, like heaven-like life that the rest of them lead.
Right.
And how do they respond to that? And how some people stay, but some people walk away from Amelas, right? Like they reject that life because of this reality that they've discovered. So I think that's where the distinction is. I don't think that most people are ignorant to the suffering and injustices that go on. I mean, is it that any Singaporean doesn't know why our streets are clean? That it is migrant workers breaking their backs and living in dormitories and eating tasteless food that doesn't fill their tummies? No, they know. It's whether we can accept it, right? Mm. Whether we desensitize, normalize, turn away from it, or turn towards it. And I think our work is not awareness. Everybody knows. Our work is to move people to turn towards these things rather than away from it.
You talk about how Singapore, the PAP, rules with an iron fist. We talk about how small the democratic space is in Singapore and how it's shrinking. You even use the word suffocating. Where do you find the courage amidst all this, pushback perhaps, from the legal side or other methods, that they use from the government, the threats, the possibilities of not getting a job? What keeps you going? Where do you find the courage to say, this is worth it? Like, I may not get a job after this. I may even go to jail for it, but it's worth it. How do you do it?
Because I think that there are a few factors. One, I think it's just very honestly, I can't shut up. I have this personality flaw, right? So in that sense, in interpersonal relationships, right, it's truly a flaw, right? Like, if I feel like annoyed about something or upset about something, I have to say. And sometimes that is definitely a weakness. But I think when it comes to acting in ways that could put me at risk in relation to speaking or acting on certain injustices or against the state, it is not necessarily always a very deeply considered decision. So it's just that I can't help myself, or I'm overwhelmed and then I'm just like, no, like, it comes from there.
Right.
So that's one part of it. But the other thing is also, on a more serious note, peers make a very big difference.
Right.
And I think in Singapore, it's definitely lonely. It's a small space, but it is the solidarity of a few other people whom I know have my back and whose back I have that helps. And that gives me a lot of strength. I think we cannot understate the value of solidarity. Sometimes it feels like an
absolutely
abused word, but in a place like Singapore, where the government pits activists against each other constantly, playing the good activist, bad activist card, making cautionary tales out of some of us, and they use all this kill the chicken to scare the monkey type of tactics, and all this is, I cannot overstate the value of having each other's backs. And that has given me a tremendous amount of grounding in continuing to do the work we do. And I think I am old enough now to be in a sort of role to welcome younger activists in the space. And that is also in itself a very energizing kind of position or posture to have in civil society, right? That I don't know whether it sounds cheesy, but it's like, we have to do this for the young ones. There's
absolutely
that thing where I know how difficult and hostile civil society as an environment was when I came into activism as a 20-year-old. So I think I'm also motivated to stay in civil society to make it a more inviting space for younger people to be when I went to my first protest and then faced investigations, the fact that I didn't have support makes me feel like, okay, when younger people now want to protest, we need to provide support. We need to raise funds for them. We need to get lawyers in place for them. We need to brief them on the risks. We need to make sure that if they need somebody to talk to their families about it, we're there. So, I think putting yourself in a role where you're also trying to create a more caring culture of solidarity and community and looking out for each other, that in itself helps to stay in the work, I think, because then you're not just invested in the issues, you're invested in this community of activists, you're invested in this community of civil society folks, right? Yeah, so because in the end, I think all of us need community, and if civil society, there is no sense of community,
right?
There is only that long that your deep, however deep your commitment to an issue is, can keep you going before you burn out, right?
Yeah. Right. Before we wrap this conversation up, how can people, whether, you know, in Singapore, outside of Singapore, even Malaysians, how can they support this movement, this collective? You know, what can people do to help you all out?
See, if you try to give us money, then we all can afford it. Yeah, but I would say it is. In fact, even with the campaigning for Nagin and Vachna and all the work we've been doing recently, it's been a tremendous energy boost and support to work with organizations in Malaysia and around the world. Like, so many groups have reached out. You know, the Anti-Death Penalty Asia Network in Malaysia, Amnesty Malaysia, so many groups have lent their support and solidarity by doing actions around this, signal boosting the issues, sharing the stories, organizing protests, vigils themselves. So I think it's really just more of that, right? So doing what we all can in our own communities, and organizing. I think organizing and talking to each other more, reaching out and sharing strategies, just coming together more strongly, I think is helpful. Because I think often we admire each other's work from afar, or we support each other's work quietly, but just picking up the phone and calling or sending texts and saying, okay, let's do something together, I think, yeah, is where things then start to move. And then we build power.
Would you have a final message for us when it comes to the abolition of the death penalty?
I think that cross-border solidarity is a tremendous force that it will move us closer to our goals. And both Malaysia and Singapore still have the death penalty. And we want to see abolition all over the world.
Absolutely.
Right? And in both of our countries. And so we need to work together as the people, you know, against these oppressive systems, and rather than working in our silos and thinking of these as only domestic issues. And I think we have seen that kind of incredible care and community grow through Nagin's case. Like, there was people from all over the world who, with an outpouring of support when his execution was imminent, and even after it happened. And I think we just, the working class around the world must unite.
Power to the people, indeed. On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Kokila.
Thank you, Dashun.
That was Kokila Annamalai, one of the founding members and an organizer at the Transformative Justice Collective in Singapore. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashun Johan, and this has been Good Things, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.